Thank you for coming.
Thank you for
I appreciate
having.
You making the trip over here to West Philly. Where are you from?
I'm from Virginia.
You're from Virginia. Okay, well, welcome to West Philly. You are at Grand Boulevard. This is the storefront for a company that I started almost 7 years ago. I was teaching high school English and mostly predominantly white students. I was the only person of color on faculty. And that gave me some freedoms, and it also gave me some opportunity to think about, you know, how do you bring white babies into a deeper sense of understanding about how we start stories and where we start stories and whose stories we tell. And so I did that through English. And then 2016, I saw Ava DuVernay's 13th, and I just decided that being in that classroom wasn't giving me the proximity to the experience of black folk or brown folk the way that I wanted. So I started volunteering at a nonprofit, getting books into prisons. And then I decided I wanted to create jobs. So this was an effort to figure out could we create, you know, radically inclusive hiring opportunities, particularly for women whose circumstance is different? And could we do it in a way that honored my regard for the planet? And so this is an expression of my quest to take care of the oppressed and to take care of the planet. And so I'm so happy you're here. I can't wait to hear all about what your experience has been like.
One, I honor you for being who you are and doing the things that you have done and for your journey, because your journey makes our meeting totally different. Hmm. The reason why I say that is because of the fact that you was a teacher, number one. Two, you
taught white students and you was trying to figure out how to give them our story. That's different, but you're a storyteller. So let me tell you a little bit about myself. So started doing art at the age of 8. Mm. Didn't understand art or the power of it. So at the age of 14, started selling drugs in high school.
Mm-hmm.
Started with weed. Well, mm-hmm. Started selling candy first.
Yeah.
Then candy moved to weed. Got kicked out of school.
Mm-hmm.
At the age of 15, got to fighting two police at the high school.
Mm-hmm.
Got kicked out. At the age of 18, got kicked out again.
Mm-hmm.
Really had never really read books, could read, but outside of the Bible had never really read. So at the age of 21, caught my first felony weed charge. At the age of 21, caught my second felony weed charge. Age of 24, got locked up for 23 years. They gave me 3 years for eluding the police and assault on 4 police officers, and 20 years for distribution of crack cocaine, 50 grams or more, in the federal system.
Mm.
While there, I ended up going back to doing art.
Mm.
I wrote my first book. It's called What If. Then around 2018, you remember when Kim Kardashian, Van Jones, Kim Kardashian, them fought for prison reform?
Mm-hmm.
I'm a recipient of it.
Oh, cool. Very interesting.
Hey.
I think you're the first person I've met.
Look, most people don't, and there's over 29,000 people who came home from that, but they do not push the narrative. And only, I think they said, it's a small percentage, a little less than 10, that have actually went back
wow.
to prison from it. But they're not sharing that information.
Wow.
So, came home. Since I've been home, my artwork has been at the World Trade Center 3 years in a row. I've exhibited in D.C. twice, Baltimore twice, Florida, Georgia, Philly. I've sold over 9,500 copies of a book I wrote, my first
what?
Book.
What? You got to teach me some things, okay?
And over 9,200 hand-to-hand and signed every one of them.
Wow.
And that was God.
Yeah.
I wasn't supposed to come out of prison till last year.
Yeah.
And I've been home for 4.5 years.
Yeah, that was God. I believe that was God. If you believe that was God.
Hey. I see it in you.
Mm-hmm.
For you to do the things that you have done and be where you are at now and still in the fight, God has a bigger plan.
I receive that and I believe that. You know, when we think about, when we talk about, when we conceptualize, when we envision mm-hmm. radical change, we have to believe that that's true. Otherwise, the pessimism would paralyze us.
I promise you. And being that you was trying to, you say you have gotten books into schools, well, prisons.
Mm-hmm.
My first book is called What If? Here we go. What if white people were in black people place and black people were in white people place? I do not wish this on white people. But you are going to see them go through the Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment, ooh, White Rosa Parks, White Ruby Bridges, Malcolm X.
This is crazy.
You're
going to
see Eric Garner, Tamir Rice,
oh,
the little girl from Texas, Colin Kaepernick if he was
and this,
white.
And this is all your work?
Uh-huh. Did a sin in prison and wrote the book. I did not change Obama.
I'm like low-key flabbergasted.
I did change Trump.
And if you know me, you know I don't. I got some words. This is crazy. This is incredible. This is incredible. It's a provocative way of thinking about how much race plays into experience and how paralyzed, going back to that word of paralysis, how paralyzed we are with the single story of what it means to be black and how much the visualization of that experience, how much it shapes everything from policy to practice to community. You know, this idea of imagining if the Black Panthers were White Panthers, what would their, and I love how you said you wouldn't wish that on anybody because, you know, it's really, really hard to step into the shoes of people who you haven't been given an opportunity to see things from their lens. I think about what's happening in the world right now. I think about what's happening to the children specifically of Gaza. And I think too about the danger of even naming them, mm-hmm, right? Like I'm very much so aware that to say that I recognize that there are children in Gaza, that I care about the children of the world, and that has to include the children of Gaza. That is also because my worldview, my aperture, holds space for their humanity. And this is what I love that your art is pushing. It's like, how do we continue to hold space for people and to really stand in their positioning? And I think if more people did that, we would be further along. I'm certain of it.
No, I realized something in doing the art. One of the reasons why I wouldn't wish it on them,
yeah,
I don't want to give them our power. You don't know how powerful you are until you go back and you look at your stories. Mostly everything that has ever been created was created by us. The filament of the light, the stoplight, the cell phone. When you go and you really, really look how deep
our contribution.
Yes, then you understand our struggle produced diamonds. This is one reason why we're empathetic. To me, to be honest, this should be on fire.
Fact. You know what? That is something that I think that there's certainly a force that understands that when you oppress people in these ways with this kind of brutality for that long, that is what you should get. And so when I think about what's happening in this American cultural conversation right now, I recognize that there is a fear of retaliation that should be warranted given the tragedy and the trauma of what the treatment of African people have been like and First Nation people, I think about the whole spectrum, all of us who have not been protected by the institutions that really uphold the preservation of the privilege of what whiteness offers. That sense that there would be a retaliation, that makes sense.
That's where their fear lies at.
Yeah.
And I think
it's not just theirs. I think it's all of ours. Mm-hmm. I think we're moving into a new moment where we're all so terrified of each other that we're all leaning into violence instead of leaning into compassion and that radical empathy and love. And that's what we've been radicalized by, that fear.
Mm-hmm.
We've all been radicalized by that fear.
And having the empathy, this is what this does.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
makes you think outside the box. Mm-hmm. What I realize, because I also do, I reverse the roles of men and women.
Mm.
I reverse the roles of...
And through your art.
Uh-huh.
So is it a what if, is it a gender novel? What's the second one?
No, it's 7 pictures that I've actually created. And then then there are 6 pictures where I did people in prison and the people in the system.
Yeah.
Congressmen.
Yes.
Judges.
The inversions. It's playing with the inversions.
Because I want people to be able to... I realized that we live in our bodies, but the only thing that can transition to think outside of your body is your mind.
That's right.
And for a lot of us, we have to be able to see what it looks like, because most of the white people that I've talked to, they say, I've never thought about it being that way.
Right.
And I realized how visual they are.
Right.
They go to museums.
We all are visual, though.
Visual, auditory.
Right, yeah.
We are more auditory, from what I've learned, than visual, even though we are visual.
Well, that would explain, in some ways, the rise in podcasts and the rise in, like, YouTube.
Listening to books.
Audio books, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then, with the visual, you got most white people go to museums a lot more.
Yeah.
Just to see. They go to orchestras just to see.
Just to hear, yeah.
And what I learned is now you only have to allow them to see. There's 4 instances in history that has really shocked the world. Mamie Till, when she actually put Emmett out there visually for the people to see. Number two, Selma, when they got beat on the bridge. Mm-hmm. According to the movie Selma,
mm-hmm.
Martin and the crew that he was with, they went down there not to start none, but to allow the world
to see it. Yes.
That they was going
to
get beat without any violence.
Mm-hmm.
The third time is Rodney King.
I knew you was going to say that had to be on the list.
Yes.
It had to be on the list. Was George Floyd.
No, before, when cell phones came out, George Floyd just became a part of it that you really got to really feel the weight of it. But ever since cell phones where you could record, it has been a mind struck.
Okay.
But that 9 minutes did something different. Now to retrain the mind, they only have to see themselves in the shoes of these people.
I mean, that's what I did as a teacher, mm-hmm. right? The idea of a teacher was to say, how can we look at a book like To Kill a Mockingbird and not mm-hmm. focus on Atticus Finch as an exemplar of noble behavior, mm-hmm. but really, really focus on Tom Robinson and how he is actually a victim in the story, right? There, mm-hmm. that was a story of like Emmett Till, mm-hmm. where he was actually the victim of the crime, right? And he served the time for the true crime.
Come on.
Right. And that was the focus of I used to teach One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It's a story of like this predominance of the focus really is on this white man who is essentially he's a pedophile and a criminal. Mm-hmm. Right. He's like a violent criminal against women. That's what he does. But I said, let's look at the story of the protagonist who actually in the story doesn't speak. He's mute the entire time. You read his thoughts, but you don't actually hear him speak. And we've zoomed in on what would it be like to live on a reservation right now? What would it be like to actually be a teen of someone your age? Mm-hmm. And what would your story and relationship with America be if you were First Nation? And that idea of shifting perspective is so huge in that growth journey.
Just to your point, you remember the movie and the book, A Time to Kill?
Oh, yeah. Not the book so much, but the movie for sure.
Yeah. I'm attached mainly to
Matthew McConaughey and Samuel Jackson.
And at the end, he paints this beautiful picture.
I gotta watch it again now.
But at the end, what he says is, imagine that she was white.
Right.
And it changes the whole dynamic of
the narrative.
Why they ended up allowing
Samuel Jackson
to go free.
Right.
And it was only
because of the visualization.
He had painted the picture.
And this is the power of art. And this is the power. I cannot tell you, I am so excited for the pieces that you're gonna show. And I struggle sometimes with what degrees of truth? No, I don't really worry so much about backlash. I don't think about backlash. I think when you're teaching and what you're offering is grounded in history and in reality and truth, then you can't really argue with that. You know, there's no argument with that. It becomes then a matter of like, are you aligning or are you already aligned with white supremacy? Mm-hmm. That's just, if you are, that's just where you are. If you are aligned with oppression, then you are just aligned with oppression. I can't do nothing with you on that one, right? Like, I'm not gonna argue with you on that. But I think there's this gap over that place where I think about, you know, how do we stay in healthy relationship with trauma, right? Mm-hmm. I had a beautiful conversation with a student who is here. She's Palestinian and she's sad. You know, when mm-hmm. I see her, she's always, how could she not be? And she says, I spend a lot of time watching what's happening in Gaza and in Rafah because I want to stay connected to the story, mm-hmm. even though I have this privilege of being in America. I told her, you got to watch your inputs because your people are going to need you to help them. And if you are saturating yourself in that trauma, mm-hmm. it may be hard for you to lead. How do you get people to interact with the visual story of this kind of reimagining while also still not
putting yourself in depth into just to your point, one of the things that I thought about doing was taking an even reversing the roles of those kids.
Mm.
I've been, I ain't gonna say battling myself with the thought because to me, I really don't care. I'm just gonna do it anyway.
But you know, the people will think that they will have all kind of new narratives that come if you show that kind of mm-hmm. empathy.
And that's all I'm working to do is imagine your kids here.
Right.
It ain't me saying that I want no Jewish kids there because I don't. I don't even want the Gazian kids there.
Yeah.
Hell, I wouldn't wanted us to go through this.
Right.
Even though I see a bigger purpose for it now.
Right.
But it's what has to happen in order for, because as you said earlier, you learn the power of art.
Right.
Art can change the world if we utilize it, whether it's through music, whether it's through visual art. It can actually change the way people perceive things.
Yeah, and I think that what it can do, in addition to the personal healing, like thinking about how it was restorative for you, right? Like how it was a pathway for you. I think art has always been such a powerful form of protest. Mm-hmm. And that's where change lives, is in our capacity to see mm-hmm. and then to act, right? It's like, how do we call people into recognition, to move them towards reflection, to push them to action? And that's what I think that art can do. And I think that that's what art is doing. When I think about even starting Grant Boulevard, it was always about how do we use the design. In this case, it was textile design to drive change, to push people into rejecting this system of fashion, which is so built on exploiting women and girls, so built on the legacies of American slavery. And that has been so many learnings, and trying to figure out how to use this, the textile arts, to push people into a new recognition that what you wear does reflect your values. And if you say you're an abolitionist, if you say you care about women, and yet you continue to just acquiesce to give into these systems that are so comfortable with dehumanization, then it becomes, who are you? I know who you think you are, but your actions don't align with what you say you aspire to. And that's the fight. The fight is, how do we use our lives to align with the values that we say we really truly hold dear, not just for other people, but for ourselves. I think about, in all of these circumstances, how when we don't really understand the conditions that we create for other people, how much we're actually setting a new sense of conditions for ourselves. Mm-hmm. We are actually saying, if I'm gonna say I'm gonna give a pass to those women and those girls being abused, in the global order, I'm saying I'm giving permission for you to come for me. So when I say I'm not gonna stand and let them be unprotected, I'm saying you ain't gonna come over here either. I'm not gonna allow myself to be unprotected and to be dehumanized and exploited. And that's where the shift happens, is like the more and more we fight, we push, we pull to make our way to attaching ourselves to that light, that's where we actually, I think, how we actually accelerate the change that has to, change is coming. Change is already happening, right? It's already happening. It's like, what are we doing to really sculpt that change, you know? How are we letting our lives sculpt that change? And that is the bigger art. That's the art of our lives.
You're using your impact to tell the story, but to heal.
Yes.
And this is what we do as artists. You're an artist in many ways, not just in textile, but
design.
In telling stories.
That's what they say.
You just said, just talk about molding.
Yeah.
That gave a visual piece to how we are shaping our future. To me, I look at the world like through a different mindset now. I realized that we are the main characters of the story.
We are all main characters.
Yeah, exactly. But how you decide to use your main characterhood is how you also become the superhero.
Or the villain.
There you go. And when you learn that you have a superpower, you can either be Professor X or, I forgot my man's name, Magneto.
Okay. You know, I don't know my X-Men references. You going to tell me?
But it's the power in learning to use, because Magneto, supposedly the guy...
He was in the wheelchair?
No, that was Professor X.
That was Professor X.
Magneto was the one with...
Oh, he's the villain.
He really wasn't a villain.
Let's talk about that.
What he was an upset character who got to see how people misuse or hated them for what they were gifted with.
Mm.
The person who actually created it created, supposedly, using Malcolm X and Dr. Martin Luther King.
Oh.
Dr. Martin Luther King being Professor X, Malcolm being
very
Magneto.
Interesting.
And when
written by a white comic book writer.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And when you actually think deep into the psychology of it, he was only showing, not that Magneto was evil, but he was upset at how they was being treated.
Right. But that's also that idea of when you start the story. Mm-hmm. If you started the story of Magneto, I mean, you know, and I'm going to stay in my lane of like, I'm not a comic book specialist. Good. But I imagine if you started the story in the moments that Magneto was being traumatized or victimized or oppressed, that would give a different sense and depth mm-hmm. to what actually informs how he navigates the world.
His thoughts.
And that's just sometimes, you know, we develop maladaptive coping strategies. You know, we're seeking survival, right? And we're trying to figure out how to be visible. For many of us, depending on, you know, the color of our skin or our gender, forces that seek to make us always villains. Mm-hmm. And that's the landscape.
They do you remember the last Joker movie, the Joker movie that came out?
I watched my inputs. I'm familiar with it, but I didn't watch it.
So they were scared of how that movie would impact, I'm gonna say, white males for real.
I mean, I was too.
Because of what they said, how they portrayed it in the movie was how he went through not being seen,
mm-hmm.
and everything, and then how, because of the fact that he wasn't seen, he
made became himself, enraged. Yes, enraged, yeah.
And how he was treated. So then, what?
This is this.
That is that.
That this is that is this. That, that is that. What if.
That is what if.
That is what if. That is what if. And that is what catapults us into this circumstance where we have a gun violence crisis, where we have a mental health crisis. Mm-hmm. And I really think of it, and my language about it is getting more precise, that it's really a poverty of spirit crisis.
There we go.
That's really what's at the floor of it, is that, you know, we're all so parched for that sense of like what's happening in our spirits. That's where we're poor first. And, you know, and that also becomes a part of how I think about design. I think about art, and I think about the power of art and how I want to be in relationship with artistic expression. It's how am I recognizing that that is the reality? And then how am I using my design practice, mm-hmm. to address that? Right, to call more people into an invitation of consciousness, and then to comfort them as they face that consciousness, and then to sit with them as they process that consciousness. And that is, I think, what I'm so excited about as we get to this body of work and what we're going to see on June the 14th at Macon Studios at 6 p.m. And I'm excited to see how that gets kind of filtered through my own experience and what it adds to my understanding. And I have to tell you the truth too, I can't wait to buy both of these. I want both the books, okay? I don't want one, I want both. And so I love this notion. We didn't talk about this one yet, maybe in another episode, the autobiography of the butterfly. But I think a lot about the reality of the butterfly and the science of the butterfly. And I can't wait to see how you have come to understand through your journey and your experience what it means to evolve, to metamorphosize.
Before I jump into that part, I do want to do, you spoke about the spirit, the poverty of the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
What I realized is we are three-part beings. Your mental only takes in what you see and what you hear. It stops. Most people don't feed their spirit. No matter what it is you believe in, you have to learn to feed yourself, because the spirit is back there impoverished. If you do not feed yourself, if you're a Christian, if you're a Muslim, you have to feed yourself daily, the same way you feed the body. And what happens is your spirit sees past what your mind and your physical shows, and you know that you can get by. But maybe that's for a later date.
That's for a later date. But you actually bring that in.
That was
I got it.
I understood where you was at.
I got it. Yeah, and I think that that's the hope. And mm-hmm. I think that when I look at the art that inspires me most, and the art that has always informed the world and really bold reimaginings of what's possible, it is art that speaks to the spirit. And it is art that offers us that sense of truth, mm-hmm. and of comfort and of optimism that is the only thing that will drive change anywhere in the world for all of us.
Whether spoken word, rap, all these art forms are art forms that God has given us to actually push and move forward.
And to stay in relationship with spirit.
Bingo.
And to stay in relationship with spirit. It's been just such a beautiful conversation. Thank you for coming here from Virginia. I appreciate you.
It was an honor for me.
One more time. We will see you again June the 14th at Macon Studios, 6 p.m. If you're in Philly, come through. It's a beautiful space. You'll get to see how we actually produce things for Grant Boulevard. And I'll give you a sense of what we have next. Really excited about the future of what we're doing here.